The scripture reading for this morning will be Mark chapter 5, verses 21 through 24. When Jesus had crossed over again by boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the sea. One of the synagogue leaders, named Jairus, came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet and kept begging him, "My little daughter is at death's door. Come and lay your hands on her so she can be well and live." So Jesus went with him, and a large crowd was following and pressing against him.
Good morning. I'm going to continue our series through the early portion of Mark this morning, looking at the strength of Jesus and how he demonstrates it and why we need to understand it. In particular, let's see if I can get that to work. There we go. Our theme has come from the third chapter of Mark, a passage we've read basically every week. If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. And if Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, but is coming to an end. But no one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods, unless he first binds the strong man. Then indeed he may plunder his house. Jesus has come into this world and is announcing his intentions. That's what makes this kind of a funny analogy. Of course, he compares himself to a thief or a bandit or a robber, but he's not like any thief or robber you've ever known, because Jesus tells you up front here what he's to do, right? I've come to tie up the strong man and take all his stuff. Never had a thief tell me that's what he was going to do. Jesus says, that's what I'm here to do. I am here to take what is in fact rightfully mine, he would say. And he has come to do that by demonstrating power over the one that currently gives us the pretense of power in this world that we live in. In Mark chapter 5, 21 through 24, there are actually two stories. Mark does something that I find very interesting as a student of the Bible to read. It's good storytelling. I don't think any other gospel writer does it. Mark, on occasion, I think four or five times in his 16 chapters, will start a story, interrupt it with another story, and then come back later and finish his story. And there's always a connection. There's always some kind of contrast between the story at the beginning and end and the story in the middle, or some kind of comparison, something that's supposed to help you. Just by way of storytelling, it's helpful to me because it helps me remember that this is real life going on. You know, in the movies, there's maybe only one thing happening at a time, and you leave your house, and then they cut the tape, and they pick back up, and you've arrived at your destination. But in real life, it doesn't work like that, right? There's travel time. The old Western movies, people used to complain because, you know, they never reloaded their guns. And the Western stars said, well, we did. We just didn't film that. There wasn't any reason to show that. It wasn't entertaining. And so they didn't show it. Well, in many of the Gospels, Jesus just travels. And then he arrived at Capernaum, and he's in the next place. But in Mark's Gospel, from time to time, he'll actually tell a story and then tell you something that happened in the meantime and then come back to his story. At first, when I saw it, I thought it was just Mark getting excited. Because I tell stories this way sometimes, where I'll start telling a story and then get distracted by another story it made me think of, and then come back to, what were we talking about? That happens, right? Does anybody else do that? Because I do a lot, as I'm told. And maybe that was what Mark was doing, but now I realize that it is actually more deliberate than that, and the contrast and comparisons are always very intentional. Later in the gospel, for example, he'll tell the story of a woman who's anointing Jesus' feet with a very costly oil. And then he interrupts it. I'm sorry, try that again. He starts telling the story of Judas going to meet with the Pharisees. He interrupts it with the story of a woman anointing Jesus' feet with a costly oil. And then he comes back to Judas making his deal for the pieces of silver. And so while one disciple was out betraying for a price, one was sacrificing out of love. And he sets those next to each other so you notice one and the other. Well, that's what happens here, to get back to our point. See, I do get lost sometimes and come back. In Mark chapter 5 and verse 21, the main story, if this is a sandwich, this is the bread on either side, the main story is the story of Jairus and his daughter. But there's going to be a very lengthy and interesting tale in between we'll get to in just a moment. It starts out like this in verse 21. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, let me just pause there. If you're here last week, we had Jesus crossing over a sea in the boat, and he went over to the place where the Gentiles were, and he does some work, and then he comes back. Now, in verse 21, he's crossing back over that same sea back into this land. A great crowd gathered around him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her, that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. Now, what's going on here? We need to think a moment about Jairus. Who is Jairus? He is the kind of person we usually expect to see in conflict with Jesus. Just as a matter of course, when you're reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, if somebody is a ruler of something, let alone if he's a ruler of a synagogue, or he works in the temple, or he's a scribe, usually they're having some kind of debate with Jesus. Usually tensions are high. Usually they've come maybe to test him, or to ask him impolite questions, or accuse him of things. That relationship is very difficult indeed. Not this time. What makes Jairus different? He's a ruler of the synagogue, so he's the same as many others in that regard, that he is a man of importance and affluence and influence. He is a person who was respected in his community and had appearances to keep up. We met another man like this in the book of John named Nicodemus. Nicodemus had questions for Jesus, but was so concerned, it appears, by what it might look like for him to come asking Jesus questions, he goes in the middle of the night alone to meet Jesus. What about Jairus? There's no indication that he's alone in the middle of the night. Quite the opposite. It seems to be the middle of the day in a crowd. And does he come accusing Jesus of something? Does he come picking a fight? Does he even send a messenger so he can kind of stay behind the scenes? No, he comes personally to stand before Jesus, and he kneels and he begs. So before you get anywhere else with Jairus, you need to recognize that this is a man with desperation on his heart. He does not want to be here. He has every reason not to be in this situation. Like Nicodemus, he has every reason, even if he's a really honest man, even if he's really curious about Jesus, he has every reason to keep his distance, and certainly not to be bowing down, and certainly not to be begging. But this is a man who is desperate. Because no matter who he is and how prominent and how influential, how wealthy he may be, how many strings he can pull behind the scenes to get things done, there is a power, there is an enemy he cannot defeat. Turns out, no matter who we are, at the end of the road of life, death is the final enemy. All of us, every last one of us, someday come face to face with death. And no amount of dexterity or business acumen or wealth or anything we can accumulate. You can do everything right. You can't, but you can do, imagine why, hypothetically, you can do everything right in this life with your life and get everything right. You could live, you could eat all the healthiest foods, you could diet and exercise, you could run a good business and raise a good family, and someday you come to meet the end of that road. And the same enemy is waiting there. Not only that, as Jairus is finding out, you will meet him several times along the way. I could tell you, I suspect very highly if you had given Jairus the option, he would have gladly traded places and met death himself, but it wasn't that bit today. Fathers shouldn't have to bury their children. And there's a certain desperation that comes with that. He has a daughter, a little daughter. And she is facing, as it says, at the point of death. And there's not a thing in the world he or anybody else he knows can do about it. He has a daughter, just like everybody else here who has a daughter. I imagine she had dad wrapped around her finger, just like every other daughter ever has her dad. Precious daughter, and there is not a thing in the world he can do about it. I have to guess, and again, pardon me for speculating, that he had already tried everything else. I don't think Jesus was his first option. If we know anything about the relationship between Jesus and the religious elite of his time, they weren't on great terms. I don't think this was option number one. I think he comes to Jesus out of desperation. And maybe, if I can be generous, maybe a little kernel of what might someday be faith. The possibility that this man whose miracles were so well known might be for real. And just that little tiny kernel of what could be faith was enough to get him going in the right direction to come personally and beg for the life of his daughter. Why should I believe that Jesus will overcome death? This is the question we're supposed to draw out of this story. Because every story in the gospel is a story about somebody else, but it's all for us. As a preacher friend of mine once said, not a single word of the New Testament is written to you, but every word of the New Testament is written for you. It's all stories about somebody else, but it's there to help me and to help you. Because you have loved ones who will face death. And someday you yourself will face that last enemy. That's the way the story goes. It has to go that way. And as Christians, we claim that we're okay. That that's the enemy, but we're going to be all right because Jesus of Nazareth is on our side. But what makes us believe that Jesus can do anything about it? If there's one thing we know about human life, it's that it ends. Nobody escapes it. No powerful general, no world leader. Everybody comes to that end. And when it happens, it happens. Why do we believe Jesus is the exception to that rule? For us, we can tell the story of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ and say, that's the reason. Jairus doesn't even have that to work with. It's based entirely on the fact that he's been healing people before now. And maybe he can do something for my daughter before she gets there. And so in the text that follows, they start walking down the road. Okay, if you look in the text again, verse 24 ended with these words, and a great crowd followed him and thronged round about him, and there was a woman. What's that? This is Mark changing stories for a moment. He's going to change gears, so hang on. He's going to tell you a completely different story that happened along the way. You see how different this is than any other story you've read about Jesus? Normally, someone comes to Jesus, Jesus heals them, end of story. This one actually tells the story of them walking down the road. They're walking down the road from wherever they were down the way to Jairus' home. Jesus says, okay, I'll go. And they go together. And what's going through Jairus' mind? As they walk, does he feel a little bit stupid? Is he concerned that he's going to arrive at the house? And what does he think's going to happen? All of his peers told him that Jesus was a fraud. He himself had probably told people that Jesus was a fraud. But here I am in desperation going to walk down to my house with this man. And what do I actually expect to happen? He's going to heal my little daughter who's sick? Maybe? You think of all the scenarios going through Jairus' mind as they go. And then along the way, something else happens. Let me read this lengthy story all together and make some comment about it. This begins in verse 25. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports that about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, if I touch even his garments, I will be made well. And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And his disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, you touched me? Who touched me? And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. So the story that interrupts this is that we're walking down the way and we get introduced to a new character, and it's a woman. Now, in many ways, this woman is going to be the opposite of Jairus, the reverse. A ruler of a synagogue in first century world context is an influential man. This woman, well, first of all, she's a woman in the first century, and so she doesn't have the rank and privileges that Jairus would have had. But she's also a woman who is diseased in some way. She has an illness, an infirmity. She's had it for 12 years. It's an illness we don't know a lot about because the text is rather unclear, except that it involves personal and intimate bleeding, hemorrhaging. It's the kind of thing that almost certainly would have made her ceremonially unclean and certainly physically weak, because you just can't bleed all the time without feeling the effects of that. So she is a person who is in weakness, who has problems being out in public because of the hemorrhaging that she's experiencing and can't stop, and she is desperate to have it stop. Anyone who would know about it would kind of make a face, because it's not even a normal disease. It's an uncomfortable disease. It's an unpleasant disease. We had this covered a couple of summers ago. We did summer series on the miracles of Jesus, and one of them took this particular passage, and they said, what do we name that one? What's the title? And we really struggled with it, because there's not a polite way to say the bleeding woman, right? It is just an awkward story to tell because of what was wrong with her. Well, she lived with that, and she lived with it for 12 years. The text said she went to doctors, such as they were in the first century. Okay, doctors in the first century, I suspect, were well-intended fellows, but be grateful that those aren't the doctors you're seeing, because there were certain limitations of science and of medicine in that particular period of what they could and couldn't do. And this was the kind of thing doctors didn't know a lot about. She's just bleeding. First time I preached on this story, I went through the great Methodist commentator Adam Clark's commentary on this passage. It's very dated now, a couple centuries old, but it has a fascinating record. He went through as many Jewish rabbinic records as he could to find examples of what kind of recommendations someone might have given a woman like this. And the stuff he found will blow your mind. I mean, it's outrageous stuff. None of it even remotely useful. But again, in desperation, doctors in this age and period were trying what they could. One of the suggestions, this is the one that I remember, and there were several that I read, but I can't remember all the details. The one I remember involved putting the woman in an intersection, in a road, in town, and then having people come up from time to time and scare her. Like walk up behind her and shout really loud. Because that ought to fix it. Right? And these were the honest doctors. I want to be fair. I'm not even picking on them. These were the good guys in the story. These were honest doctors saying, you know, yeah, this might work. I learned this in medical school, such as it was. We put you in the middle of the street and yell at you. And there was something involving a chicken. I'm trying to remember that one, but it was really complicated. It didn't work. And then what else might she have faced? Think about this. Some of you have been faced a serious illness, maybe a terminal illness, or known walked along with a person who faced a terminal illness. What else happens? What always happens is the non-professionals get involved. Well-intended friends come along and say, my mother-in-law had that. And I read on the internet somewhere that if you... And then they tell you to stand in the intersection and let someone scare you. Or the whatever the 21st century equivalent of scaring a person in an intersection is. And they tell you this is what's going to work. This is the secret cure for cancer that they don't know about, right? And they try to give you advice. And at first you think, oh, crazy friends, but then you're desperate. This is 12 years of this, right? 12 years of this. And so I suspect she tried some stuff. And again, those are the honest people. And then come the dishonest people. Come on down to Ben's house of medicine. What do you got? Well, I'm bleeding. Oh, yeah, you know, my mother had a broken arm too. What, bleeding? Oh, yeah, my mother had bleeding just like that. I remember. Yep, just like that. I gave her some of this, and I'm about out. It'll cost about twice what it regularly cost. Oh, yeah, fix it right up. Fixes broken arms. I mean, bleeding every time. Yeah. I mean, every penny she has, first to the honest, then to the honest but misguided, and then finally to the crooks and the charlatans. She had spent everything she had, and the text says she's not better, she's worse. And again, if you read some of the medical practices of the first century, worse is very easy to understand. Throughout most of the ancient period, even down to like the time of George Washington, people thought if you're bleeding, it probably needs to come out, so let's get all that out of there. I mean, George Washington was practically bled to death, right? And so this woman, not better, but worse. And so she's happens to be in the same area. Jesus is passing through with a crowd, and she actually has a little more of that faith we talked about. Jairus might have the tiny kernel of faith. She has a little more. She says, if I could just touch him. Touching him, touching the hem of his garment, is more likely to heal me than anything else I've faced in all these years and gone through. And so this woman who is unclean, this woman who is not particularly acceptable in a crowd, makes her way through the crowd and sheepishly reaches out, touches the hem of his garment. And her faith makes her whole. The power of Jesus. Jesus, how does Mark describe Jesus? Jesus is not just a strong man. He is a man of such incredible power, it just oozes out of him. If you get too close, you might be healed of something. That's the kind of power that Jesus has. She touches him and she's healed. And Jesus has to turn around and ask about it. Notice that she, in her story, is the mirror image of Jairus. Jairus comes and bows down and says, I need healing. And Jesus says, let's go for a walk. This woman comes into the crowd and is healed, and then comes and she bows down before Jesus after it happens, to give credit where it is due. Now, why does Mark need us to know this story? And what is Jairus thinking while it's happening? You ever go into a department store, and this happens to me all the time, I'm in Lowe's, and I'm looking for a part, I'm looking for a widget, you know, whatever it is that I've got to have. I've got to have a 3/4-inch widget, you know, I've got to have that piece, the only piece that fits. And so I find somebody who looks like they know what they're doing, and I say, can you help me find the 3/4-inch widget, you know, whatever it is I'm looking for. And he says, yeah, sure, and we go walking. And then somebody else comes and says, hey, by the way, in your plumbing section, you're missing the half-inch PEX connections. Do you know where those are? And my guy starts following them. Hey, wait a second. That's my guy. I had him first. He's helping me. Mr. Williams, I'll be back with you in just a minute. No, right? Jairus is walking down the road. He's kind of in a hurry. His daughter is dying. It's not like they're going grocery shopping. They're in a hurry, and he's already nervous. He's already concerned. He already feels out of place. He already feels a fair bit embarrassed to even be with this person, Jesus, in such desperation. And then we're going to stop and talk to people? We're going to stop, and here's this woman, mess that she is, and we're going to have a conversation with her. Why do we do this? I suspect there's a reason for it, and Mark is helping us see it. Along the road of life, we encounter other battles which prepare us for the final enemy. If at death's door we met Jesus for the first time, I think we would find it difficult to appreciate who and what he is. But along the road of life, we have these opportunities to be interrupted by other people's stories. And we get to see Jesus doing wonderful things in their lives. And that helps us in our journey. You see, if we're selfish, we think the whole journey is about us. I'm walking with Jesus. I found him in Lowe's, and he's coming with me until I get what I need. And Jesus keeps helping other people. And if we're selfish, we think, well, we don't have time for that. Come along now. But he's not your Jesus. Not like that. We don't get to be possessive. Not in that sense. He possesses us. And along the way, we see him working in the lives of other people. Can I suggest to you, that's what a church is? A church is a group of people walking down the road together with Jesus. And on the way to the various obstacles that we see, we get to see Jesus working in other people's lives as well. Why do we bother with the announcements? I mean, I am one of the most impatient people with announcements. I really am. Every few months, I come up with a new scheme to get rid of them altogether. I do get impatient with announcements. But there's a reason we do them, and the elders always remind me, Ben, there's a reason we do them. It's important. And it's because we need to know. Not because we like gossip, but because we need to hear the story. And we tell all the stories. One person's having a baby. One person's burying a relative. One person's diagnosed with cancer, one person's cancer's in remission. One person's getting better, one person's getting worse. We weep with those that weep, we rejoice with those that rejoice, and we do it all together. And we hear these stories, and we let them interrupt us as we walk down the road, because we need to know that God is at work in the world. We need to know that God is working in people of faith. When other people come forward and confess their sins, we need to know, not because we like to gossip about their sins, but because we need to know there are other people facing sin like us, and that Christ is forgiving them just as well. A church is a place where we walk together. It's not just about me. We go down this road together because there's going to come a day when I'm going to need the strength that you provided, because I didn't have it myself. Jairus didn't have the faith he needed. I don't believe it. But I believe this woman did. And so look at the next text very carefully and see if that's not a connection that's made in the text. Verse 34 and 36. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." See how important it is that these stories are on top of each other? He's talking to the woman, and Jairus has to be standing by a little bit annoyed that this is going on. And he's telling her, faith, faith is what has already healed you. Because of faith, you go your way in health. And while he's speaking, the moment where Jairus was going to need to summon all the faith he didn't have came and arrived. His worst fear came to pass. We didn't get there in time. He might have had a little kernel of faith that Jesus the healer could heal his sick daughter. I do not believe that when he went to Jesus, he had any faith that Jesus the healer could heal his dead daughter. So we got to borrow some. Great thing about faith, you can borrow it. He got to borrow some from this woman who had enough faith. This woman who got to see something marvelous and wonderful happen. And while it was happening, that's when he gets the news. Your daughter is dead. Don't bother him anymore. Why do they say that? Sickness is one thing, dead is another. It's over, it's done. And it's at that moment that Jesus can turn from speaking in one miracle to speaking to the potential for another and say, "Do not fear, only believe." Jairus needed that. In the same way, I need to borrow your faith some days, and you mine. We need each other and the strength each one provides. The effortless power of Jesus over all of life's enemies helps us to believe he will triumph over the final enemy. Every time he does good in your life, it helps me prepare for the end of mine. Each time he helps you get through the loss of a loved one, it prepares me for the day that I lose mine. We need the faith of these stories shared together along the road of life to see the powerful and effortlessly powerful Jesus at work in every direction. And so the story continues, and Mark picks up where he left off before. In verse 37, "And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. And they came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue. And Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, 'Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping.' And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was." Why is Jairus still talking with Jesus? Why is Jairus still walking with Jesus? Why doesn't he say, "Well, never mind"? When they tell him his daughter is dead, why does the man who barely had enough faith to begin with keep going down that road? Because there was a woman with an issue of bleeding. And he had been there to see enough to produce enough faith to get down the road a little further. And when he gets to his home and he sees the tears and the moaning, he now has just enough faith to keep walking through that doorway. When Jesus starts saying things that sound patently absurd, "You don't know what dead is." Listen, if there's something we understand, I picked on first century medicine for a moment, but there was one thing they were pretty good at. They knew when people were dead. That one's not particularly difficult. And they said, nah, she's asleep. Which, just to be clear, I'll give you my opinion. This is Ben's two cents, and that's really all that it's worth, maybe just one. I don't think Jesus is saying they misdiagnosed her. Okay? Some of the commentaries take it that way, that actually she was in some sort of coma and they thought she was dead and Jesus wakes her up. I don't think it's what happened. I think she's very, very dead. But when Jesus encounters death, to him it's just sleep. That's the way Paul talks about death. Those that are asleep in Jesus will be raised up. To them, death wasn't permanent. Death was something you woke up from. Jesus sees a young girl who's dead, and they have the tears of death on their faces, and he says, it's not that kind of death. She's asleep. You didn't diagnose her wrong, you believed wrong. You lacked faith in what God was going to accomplish. But why does Jairus listen when others mourn, and then when others laugh? This is a man of position and influence. We talked about that at the very beginning. He is now a joke. And you know how this story ends? Pretend you don't for a moment. When Jesus goes into that room with him and the family, and she stays dead, do you think Jairus is still the leader of his synagogue? Listen, I don't care who you are and how important and influential you are. If you start buying into witch doctors on a regular basis, people are going to talk. If you take strange men to the cemetery and try to raise the dead, people aren't going to leave you in your position very long. He has taken an enormous risk. For him, he considers it worth it. Part of it's desperation, but part of it is the faith he was able to borrow for a woman who was bleeding. And so the story does end the way that we know that it does, in verse 41 and 42. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kumi, which means, little girl, I say to you, arise. And immediately the little girl got up and began walking. She was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. This is the second time in Mark's gospel where Jesus has faced down an insurmountable foe with a whisper. Peace be still. Little girl, arise. Effortless power. He has enough power to do what needs to be done. Touching the hem of his garment is enough. The whisper of Christ is more powerful than the greatest of our adversaries. And that's what we too have to come to believe, as did Jairus. The Apostle Paul reminds me of this very story when he says these words in 1 Corinthians 15:24. Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father after destroying every rule and every authority and every power. For he must reign until he has put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. For God has put all things in subjection under his feet. We get to see one day at a time the rule of heaven in our lives. We get to see the power of Christ over every other enemy along the way. Because we're being asked by God to believe in an ultimate victory at the end. We need the little victories to get us there. We need to borrow the faith of each other to help us believe that one day that last enemy is finally defeated. That last strong man finally bound. Talitha kumi, little girl, arise. If you would respond to the effortless power of God and see him raise up your life to what it ought to be, respond to his whispered call. As we stand and sing a word of invitation, won't you come?